Hey everyone, Samuel Donner here, the host of Finding Founders. We finished up our drug dealer series last week and oh my God, it was such an incredible experience. So interesting to dive into this underground world. And what was really, really awesome is seeing all the new people and new listeners that came to the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Finding Founders is growing more and more every day. And if you're trying to figure out, hey, how should we support the podcast? For now, please just share with a friend or post a screenshot to your socials. It really helps. Also, if you can, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Anyway, finishing up this past series, the drug dealer series, which is our second one, reminded of our first series, the first one we ever did. I actually traveled over to Puerto Rico to interview leaders over there and hear how the entrepreneurial community recovered after the 2017 hurricanes. And today, I wanted to do a rebroadcast of the first episode in our three-part series on Puerto Rico. I really, really hope you enjoy. Talk soon.
When the hurricane hit, I was at home with my wife. You know, you could hear the sound of the wind of a hurricane is somewhat different. It's more like a roar. Our house was flooded. We started seeing water coming from the ceiling. There was a point when I was scared. I was really scared. You know, running out of water and food, and those are really scary things. In the middle of such strong winds, and you see things flying and hitting, and you realize that I don't control the situation. I don't have any control of what's happening.
This is Finding Founders. I'm Samuel Donner. And today we're releasing the first of three episodes exploring Puerto Rico. So I traveled to San Juan, Puerto Rico a few weeks ago, and I was trying to understand why Puerto Rico's entrepreneurial community emerged more vibrant after the 2017 hurricanes, specifically Hurricane Maria. My question is, how can destruction sow the seeds of opportunity and growth? And our first interview is with Nelson, who was just describing the destruction that Hurricane Maria dealt to his hometown in Ponce, Puerto Rico. In spite of the tragedy that hit his community, I would say that hope still prevailed. And I would say that hope was a catalyst for positive change. Today, Nelson is the president of the Puerto Rico Community Foundation, an organization dedicated to the development of underprivileged communities in Puerto Rico. Nelson has spent much of his life engaging in humanitarian efforts, but his story, when marked by social injustice and family tragedy, didn't start there. It started with his father, the illegitimate son of a sugar plantation worker and the owner.
The economic structure of Puerto Rico rests on a highly specialized agricultural system.
My grandmother on my father's side was the mistress of the guy who used to be the manager of the sugarcane plantation.
Sugarcane is king, the principal source of income.
So my father was a sugarcane cutter until he was 16. He decided that he wanted a different life, and he was going to move to the big city. That was Ponce. My father was a fast learner. He was very, very self-taught person, but he studied a lot. He located in a black neighborhood in 1926 in the city of Ponce. And there was an opportunity with the Ponce Diamond Work. And he was hired as a messenger just observing how diamonds were polished.
Diamonds, diamonds, and more diamonds.
Then if you want to learn that trade as an apprentice, they will not give you diamonds. They'll give you ball bearings, which obviously burns much, much faster. And he became very skilled. Then he was promoted from being an apprentice to being a polisher, then to be a maestro. The biggest diamond on earth by that time was the Yonkers. And the Yonkers was cut in 12 pieces.
25 years ago, one of the world's most famous diamonds, the fabulous Yonkers Stone, arrived in America. The world's largest, it was discovered only the year before.
And they selected the best 12 diamond polishers from the U.S. and Puerto Rico, and he was one of them. So he went there, he stayed strict security measures. The diamond was polished, I would say like in a month, but he stayed there several years afterwards. Then he returned, and when he returned as the manager of the factory. That's how he ended up, you know, being star diamond polisher.
Nelson's father seems like a prime example of the self-taught man, someone who changed his life for the better through hard work. As an illegitimate son, he was born into a harsh environment, almost like a chunk of graphite buried miles beneath the Earth's surface. But these intense conditions, coupled with his own perseverance and a willingness to learn, molded this piece of soft rock into a glistening gem, one that would bring joy to many lives, including Nelson's. Look closely enough, and you will see the parallels between Nelson's story and his father's. And although the sources of pressure weren't identical, they grew up with similar social expectations.
We learned to be hardworking people. We also learned that our future, there was some sort of leadership position because my father was a leader in his field. But at the same time, we were not participating of what we saw at the time, the good life in Puerto Rico. In the few occasions that we went places in the city, we felt that we didn't belong. In the narrative of that culture, you knew what were the places, the social clubs, the parties where you could go, and were those spaces where you knew that you wouldn't be admitted. Because these were clubs, schools, restaurants that would exclude black people and poor people. So by looking at those parallel tracks, you keep asking yourself, why are we not walking together through life? Why are we going to separate churches? What are we going to different schools? Anytime those two tracks do intersect, then all the cultural defenses just go up and manifest itself in the form of bullying, the racist bullying.
Nelson's childhood experiences as a black person in Puerto Rico brings to mind the stories of black Americans in the segregated South.
We believe that our problem is one not of violation of civil rights, but a violation of human rights.
Although I knew a bit about the history of racism in America, my classes didn't quite cover Puerto Rico, so we did a bit of digging. Racism in Puerto Rico has a long history. But I think the event that wedded Puerto Rican and American racial history occurred in 1898.
Modern structures symbolize Puerto Rico's progress during 43 years under the American flag, in the realization of which its 2 million peace-loving people are cooperating patriotically to forestall the spread of totalitarian tyranny to the shores of the Americas.
The United States invaded Puerto Rico, upheld the racial hierarchy, and accentuated anti-Afro-Puerto Rican sentiments.
What are some of the reasons that you found Puerto Ricans choose to identify as white on the census.
As upper-class white people entered Puerto Rico, they made deals with the U.S. industrialists and supported policies that violated civil rights and exploited the Afro-Puerto Rican people.
And some people consider this to be the vestige of colonialism. There was a policy known as Gracias a Sacar, where you could actually petition the Spanish Empire to be classified as white, because if you were black, that meant there were certain professions that you couldn't hold and opportunities that you couldn't have, very similar to the United States.
And Nelson had to live with that systemic racism. With the guidance of his father, Nelson developed solid principles that pushed him to defy the confines of this system built to break him. Education would be his vehicle to escape societal limits, and his family provided a safe environment in which he could pursue that.
I had a very close relationship with my mother and my sister, but then the figure that I saw doing most of the maternal roles was my older sister. We came to this world into two cohorts. So there were 17 between the first and the last. So, you know, that gang of siblings really became like a protective squad. So it was an interesting way of being raised. In a way, that's my concrete experience of being raised by the village. Let me go back to why my mother perceived threats in the environment. I have an uncle who died because he just jumped into the trolley without paying. I mean, must have been 2 cents. So he was hidden by a police who saw him with a stick. Now the police hit him in the back. His lungs collapsed and he died. So we grew with these stories that there are threats out there. So when the band came together, we were a protective clan because, you know, your whole life could be in peril.
Stories like this one of racially charged violence against the Colon family led Nelson's mother to shelter him. Shelter him from the ideology of a system that not only aspired to stifle his success, but was actively killing people that looked like him. But a sheltered childhood wasn't necessarily bad. I think it served to strengthen the bonds he had with his siblings and parents. And nurturing these relationships undoubtedly bolstered his integrity and sense of community. His home was a place that allowed him to thrive, allowed him to grow up unencumbered by the worst of racism. He didn't have to worry as much about the color of his skin. He could just focus on personal growth. But sometimes the family couldn't protect itself. You get into the University of Puerto Rico, and then pretty soon after you start, your father has that heart attack.
Yeah, it was a complicated experience. It was painful. I mean, he was a healthy guy. He was in the pinnacle of his career, and all of a sudden, all came down. So we move out from our house to a smaller house. The boys in the family, we started working with him in the shop. My brother was already working with him. We were worried that he was going to die. We were worried that we were turning poor. We didn't have the income to keep the type of life that we were used to live. I moved, for example, from private schools to public schools. My brother remained working at the factory. My two other brothers started working with him on a regular basis. So our whole life structure was transformed. At the same time, 1963, Kennedy was killed.
Here is a news bulletin from the CBC Television News Service.
Here is a picture of President Kennedy and his wife taken just before he was shot today in Dallas, Texas.
So that was a major shockwave in our family. So that was the backdrop of my admission to the university. You know, very times were very convulsive. The nationalist movement in Puerto Rico was on the rise. They were very afraid of that. Puerto Rico had, at that point, two strong forces. One was pro-statehood, the second one was pro-independence. And Puerto Rico was trying to find a way to move forward. The Nationalist Party evolved from a party to a liberation force. And in the 1950, they declared a revolution in Puerto Rico. They had armed confrontation.
Then revolution and the attempted assassination of Puerto Rico's governor.
They took over the town of Ayuya. They raised their flag.
Bullets ripped through that flag and through the palace windows behind, only just missing Governor Luis Marin. 40 were killed in the course of the uprising, which was ascribed to communists as well as...
So all the families were highly concerned by the consequences of the nationalist movement. So my family was really scared.
Needless to say, the social structure around Nelson's life had shifted drastically. Puerto Rico's nationalist movement 13 years before was still sending ripples throughout the island. Then there was JFK's assassination, the death of a man who had been so crucial to the vitality of Puerto Rico. But what shook him to the core was his father's heart attack and its unceasing consequences. An important takeaway from this anecdote is that life can change in an instant. And no matter how good you have it, reality spares no one. Nelson couldn't mourn the past. He had to look towards the future. And the future was education. But that future was not without complications.
I got good grades in school. So I went to the school counselor and I just said, you know, I need my papers to fill those forms and send it to the University of Puerto Rico. And then she said, no, I will not give it to you, because you will never be admitted to the University of Puerto Rico. And that really was like a dart in my heart. I mean, we grew thinking we need to go to the university, we need to have a profession. She was a gatekeeper and she was blocking black students to apply to the University of Puerto Rico. So how did we go around that? My mother, basically, she said, if she doesn't give you the documents, the forms to apply, I will get it myself. So she had the documents to apply to the university. And I did. I had to do it all by myself. The University of Puerto Rico was the best university, having me admitted to the university. So I remember the joy, I remember the celebration, and the concern as well. I mean, I was coming from Ponce to San Juan, so I was crossing the island, I was, coming to the other side of the island.
College meant opportunity, a chance to think for himself, develop his own moral judgment. His mother had instilled in him this idea that education is a right, not a privilege. And education was a push he needed to get to the other side of the tracks, to leave the shackles of racism that had previously smothered his progress. His family had given him an opportunity to grow, but now he had to stand on his own two feet, decide how he wanted to combat the societal barriers that plagued people that grew up like him. Instead of succumbing to violence, Nelson took a different route. You studied sociology. I imagine you're trying to understand that. So I guess like how did you go about understanding your roots and your country?
So I went into my college life with all those questions in my head. So I started flirting with the pro-independence movement when I was in high school. So I thought I was, I had a lot of curiosity. They have this aura of local heroes. Essentially, I became a pacifist. I became a conscientious objector of the Vietnam War.
Operation Pershing on the Bong Son Plain in South Vietnam. A major offensive drive by U.S. 1st Cavalry soldiers determined to seek, find, and rout a huge Viet Cong force from the area.
And I was highly influenced by Martin Luther King thinking.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia.
So while I transit through the university, I realized that I preferred the non-violent option to the violent option because I didn't see, you know, the chances for winning. Winning my mind was political power at that point. So the connection is you have an armed struggle because eventually you will win, and once you win, you will acquire political power. So I was thinking all the time, that's not the way to go. For me, those were really formative years, those years in college.
Leaving his town and going to university gave Nelson fresh perspective on the concept of community. Nelson's philosophical enlightenment in college reminds me of a quote by Martin Luther King. The function of education is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. Intelligence plus character. That is the true goal of education. The knowledge that Nelson accrued certainly helped him strengthen his moral character. He began to see that community involves not just family, but society as a whole. And being part of a functioning society means working with people with vastly different beliefs and backgrounds. Nelson did his best to work harmoniously with these people, just as he did in choir, singing alongside others with different interpretations of the same pieces. Embracing these differences allowed Nelson to stop viewing the outside world as a threat and instead seek to understand it in its flawed but beautiful entirety. He'd spread the idea that social change can occur peacefully across the world.
We went to Jamaica. That was my second trip out of Puerto Rico for a student Christian movement convening. So I came first in contact with theologians, that they were mostly in the theology of liberation movement. Basically, it was God's mandate is to side with the poor. God's mandate is a mandate of service and devotion to the other person. And that encounter in Jamaica was really nice for me. You know, I met a lot of people. I met, you know, girls.
Did you?
On the way back, I was traveling with a girl that I thought she was beautiful and kind and soft. So I've been sitting by her for the last 51 years.
Really?
Yeah.
So it went very well.
So it went very well. It really went well.
On that trip, Nelson met his life partner, the woman who would become his wife. Though this is momentous in itself, I think another important aspect of this trip was perspective. Nelson altered and expanded his worldview and cemented this idea of caring for the world. If he was expected to provide for this community in Jamaica, if his duty was to care for the poor even in countries he had no attachment to, then coming home must have sparked an intense drive to pursue social justice and community development on his home island of Puerto Rico.
So I applied to the Puerto Rico Planning Board, and they made me like director of their youth program. I was more inclined to see community organizing. I was inclined to see myself embedded in community work. So finally, I saw in that concept of community something tangible that I could work with. Finally, was able to go into communities, work with communities, work with slums.
You were going into the communities and trying to help and take action. What was the action that actually occurred?
We started organizing people, and I just met this lady. And she said, we want a basketball court. So I said, you are on my turf. If you want a basketball court, we'll build a basketball court. So basically there was one. So we just fixed it. We just renovated it. It's a very unique sense of satisfaction, mostly because I helped people do it. I supported people in their process of doing that. It is pretty much like the birth of new life. I mean, there was nothing, and then all of a sudden there is this, you know, real nice things be used by the young people in the barrio, and their mothers and fathers are excited.
Sitting in a white office building did not spell change for Nelson, but repaving basketball courts did. He wants to contribute to his community with his own two hands, physically immersing himself in that community and his work. And Nelson wasn't worried about getting the glitz and the glory. To him, community improvement is rewarding in itself. Many think community improvement is about beautification, but really, it's about unification. It isn't about discarding the less desirable parts, but it's about reinvigorating them. And Nelson would go ahead to reinvigorate many different parts of his community. But soon, a virus would disrupt his piecemeal approach to philanthropy.
The AIDS pandemic sort of started becoming a public health crisis in Puerto Rico. We here at the foundation, we funded the first hospice for dying patients. But then when you see that, when you come in contact with that, and when you see people dying because a preventive illness, you realize that you sort of try to save the victim after they are drowned.
He knew he was providing tangible services, but he still felt disconnected. Like the projects he was doing was just solely to do projects. He didn't want to just patch holes. He wanted to create lasting solutions that would span generations. But his efforts would be tabled as he faced a more immediate threat to his community.
Hurricane Irma is barreling towards the Caribbean with winds reaching 180 miles per hour.
So when Irma hit Puerto Rico, I mean, you just hunker down, cover yourself.
The Category 5 storm has prompted hurricane warnings in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
So I was thinking at that point, as a foundation, we are going to do what we have always done, which is we will activate the recovery fund. We have all the protocols in place. We will support communities we work with, and we move forward. But then while I was trying to organize those thoughts, Maria hit us. We were not ready for the number of people who died. When the hurricane hit, I was at home with my wife. Our house was flooded. I mean, we started seeing water coming from the ceiling. There was a point when I was scared. I was really scared. You know, running out of water and food. And I mean, those are really scary things. Everything is disorganized. Everything falls. Everything. It's difficult. It's difficult to communicate. In the middle of such strong winds and, you know, you see things flying and hitting, and you realize that, you know, I don't control the situation. I don't have any control of what's happening. So let's sit tight and let's hope. All of a sudden, your neighborhood becomes like a ghost town. Houses are broken, windows are broken, things that were inside spaces are out, falling into pieces. To me, it creates the profound sense of sadness. Everything is destroyed.
The bustling and joy-filled streets that he called home were replaced by broken windows, uprooted trees, and a flooded city. The world he knew, the community that he helped build, was literally turned upside down in less than a day. For Nelson, someone who dedicated the better part of his life to ameliorating communities, this force of nature literally undid all of his hard work in a blink of an eye, and I can imagine that would be demoralizing. His self-worth was tied to the vitality of his community. This would knock Nelson down, but he wouldn't stay down for long.
Another colleague wrote me a single note saying, "I know that you have been hit hard, but create strategic pathways for whatever you're going to do. Otherwise, you will exhaust yourself." I devoted like 6 hours just writing ideas of how the foundation can react to the situation. We came with very simple solutions, and you can still see those around. One simple solution was access to water. So we decided, and we're going to do these in 3 phases. The first phase is having our organizations. We are going to provide them with water purifiers. Secondly, we support organizations that were digging water holes. And thirdly, then we decided to start working with a water system owned and managed by the community. So all those 3 stages were ways of providing access to that critical resource. For 8 months, almost half of the island was without access to electricity. So basically, we followed the same logic. First, we distributed lanterns. Secondly, we distributed about 80 generators. And thirdly, we started working around the idea of solar communities. Still, to this day, 3 years later, those solar communities are still beacons of light for the rest of the island.
Nelson was looking to the future. In a way, Hurricane Maria spurred him to action, pushed him to create permanent changes in his community. After all, Puerto Rico was his home. But what constitutes a home? Some say a home is physical entities that make up your house, and others say it's the people you surround yourself with. For Nelson, it's both. Puerto Rico was the place he grew up, the place he made his fondest memories. It was also the place where he endured some of his greatest tragedies. But the streets, the people, and the culture have shaped him into the humanitarian he is today. And Nelson wasn't going to stop at water purifiers and solar communities. He was going to tackle any disaster that would come towards Puerto Rico. And the next pressing issue was COVID.
We learned from Maria. For this to be resilient in the long term, for this to be sustainable, communities needs to have access, needs to have the knowledge of the management of the resource, and needs to have ownership. So we took those 3 concepts, and when COVID hit, we started looking with the same thinking. Let's develop strategic framework to deal with this. And I wrote a document I called the Strategic Redirection of the Foundation. One will look at that and saying, to contain this virus, we need community education, by the community, with the community. The second set of activities is those communities need money, need investment. Need investment for the personal protective gear. They need investment for food, for creating the conditions where people can have access to health services. Thirdly, we identified resources of the community. We have in almost every community a nurse who does the work of doing the initial screening. And fourthly, we create a large alliance in Puerto Rico. We have like over 30 allies. And basically the notion is, let's all the allies zero in into not having one person who died in the age bracket of 65 and over. We started that in March, almost 8 months later. We don't have one single death due to COVID in that age range. Community contact tracing, community education, access to health services.
Nelson had a plan, but even with a plan, he still needed a community, a group of people who were willing to help him turn his vision into a reality. Sure, social distancing and wearing face masks played a part in containing the spread of COVID in Puerto Rico, but I think more importantly, it was the unity with which Nelson and his comrades approached the situation. Creating lasting change in a community is a group effort. It's a mindset, a culture of togetherness that will create a movement. What advice would you give your younger self, your 20-year-old self that's maybe dipping your toes in those movements? What advice would you give that person to have like real impact within a community?
There needs to be a clear vision of what is the end goal? What is the new Puerto Rico that we want to build? Having those pathways, that vision would be my advice. Don't rush. Think a little bit and you will get there.
Nelson is intensely community driven. In a way, that's incredibly unique. He isn't driven by materialism or self-aggrandizement. He has this innate drive to do good, to make a positive impact in his community. So many of us have this I mentality, this desire to work hard to better our lives. But Nelson constantly thinks in terms of we. From helping middle schoolers to combating COVID, Nelson has always had his community's best interest at heart. But I think what I've learned about community from Nelson is that it can start small. When Nelson built those basketball courts, when he was providing relief for the hurricane, those projects started with conversations. He asked, "What do you need?" Sometimes that question is all it takes to create change. Now, more than ever, I think we should ask our friends, our neighbors, our community that simple question. What do you need? From there, we can create an answer together and create something beautiful. Create a community. See you next week. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, DM us at Finding Founders Podcast on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Facebook. Finding Founders is produced and hosted by me, Samuel Donner.
Our editing lead is Adrian Thapia, with the support from
Joseph Cho,
Eli Lauren,
Matt Fernandez,
Amir Gold,
Spencer Khan,
Sophia Donner, and Shannon O'Halloran.
Our script writing team lead is Joyce Mock, with support from
Avnish Sengupta,
Prerika Chawla,
Mitchell Lin,
and Gemma Brandwolf,
Elizabeth Bowen,
and Sharon Chen.
Our outreach and research lead is Jessica Lin, with support from
Sasha Ivanova,
Marie Vaughn,
Lisa Le,
Alice Yao,
Ankita Nambiar,
and Jamil Swayze.
Our design and social media team lead is Annie Liu, with support from
Phoebe Sajor,
Tiffany Dang,
Rick Liu,
Ayla Erickson,
Shruti Ramanand,
Lingmu Hu,
and James Barton.
To see more of what we're up to, subscribe to our newsletter at findingfounders.co. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week.